Hardware Store, where your dollar buys more, River Street in Montpelier.
I love Hunger Mountain Co-op because as a working member, I get to hang all of the co-op posters you see in town. It keeps me connected to my community, and I get a discount. I'm Karen Gerdell from Montpelier, and I've been a member owner since 1998.
It's time to get the story behind the story. Interviews with newsmakers, newsbreakers, and your phone calls. Radio Vermont presents The Mark Johnson Show.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the program. Thanks for tuning in. We all made it to a Friday. Congratulations. We got a great program on tap for you. Coming up in about a half an hour, we're going to be joined by John Dillon. He's the news director at Vermont Public Radio, one of the best journalists in Vermont today. We'll also be taking your phone calls throughout the program. That might entice him in case he's on the way and wavering whether or not to actually arrive here at the studio. Maybe that will draw him in. Plus, we're giving away bags of Vermont Coffee Company coffee to guests that show up here on the at their studios today. And let's say hello to our first guest this morning. I feel like we were talking yesterday with this really interesting musician who, among the things that he did, was the dating game theme. And I sort of feel like we're doing a little bit of the dating game here. Let's give a nice home Radio Vermont welcome this morning to our first guest today. Let's welcome Charles W. Johnson, who I have to tell you, Charles is a fascinating guy. He's an author, worked for the state. He's a naturalist. And he's also the author of a number of books, including his most recent one is Ice Ship, The Epic Voyages of the Polar Adventurer Fram. And he's kind enough to join us in our studios. If you want to join us on the phone, you can at 244-1777, toll-free 877-291-8255. Charles, thanks for joining us. How are you this morning?
Good, Mark. Thanks for the nice introduction.
Let's talk a little bit about you. You grew up, tell me about where you grew up off of Cape Cod.
Well, my family and I spent 23 summers on an island off of Woods Hole, Mass. It's called Nishan Island, 8 miles long. We lived on the, spent the summers on the far west end. No roads, no cars, no electricity, no running water, just nature. Just the sea and the land around it. And our nearest neighbor was across the next island over, a lobster fisherman and his wife. That was it. So we spent the summers. My dad was an academic professor, and we spent the summer, the whole summer. In those days, you could spend the whole summer. And that's where I got my immediate attachment to the sea and to nature, really.
What was that like?
Pretty amazing. Pretty remarkable. For a young person to go for that long without any other kind of outside, we didn't have newspapers, we didn't have radio then, we didn't have any kind of communication except, the occasional person who stopped by. So for a young person, I think that spent a lot of time looking inward and looking outward. So it was very formative.
Who'd you hang out with?
Horseshoe crabs, fish, did a lot of fishing. My family, of course. My brother and I I have one brother, and we didn't have a lot to do with each other, but we were companions in those days, and we did things together. So, and of course, it built our bonds with the parents pretty closely. Of course.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned your dad was in academia. Tell me more about that.
Yeah, he was a professor of physiology, and. I think for me, he was also he loved the Arctic. And during the war, World War II, he spent time developing the K and C rations that were the survival rations for troops. And he spent a lot of time in the Arctic testing Canadian troops about these rations. And that's where he got his love of the Arctic. And then he ended up accumulating a lot of books and interviewing, all sorts of people about Arctic exploration. And he had a big library. And growing up, I would sort of immerse myself in his library as well. So, mm-hmm. But he was an interesting guy. His parents, grandparents were from Norway. And so we have that northern connection that way as well.
You mean you and me, you're talking about your dad?
Well, us too. A lot of Johnsons out there.
Yeah, there certainly are. In fact, my dad, I mentioned to you before the show, was named Charles Johnson, yeah. As is my brother. So tell me about your mom.
My mom was born and raised in New Zealand. Her father was a sea captain who ended up settling in New Zealand and became the harbor master of a small a port of Christchurch called Lyttelton, where in those days he was he sort of welcomed the great Antarctic explorers, Shackleton and Australian Douglas Mawson and Scott and those people. So I never met my grandfather, but I knew that he was with these people. So her family, though, from New Zealand, was also ultimately from Scotland. They emigrated from Scotland, so another northern connection there.
I'm getting the sense of where your interest came for this most recent book.
Right. Yeah, I mean, maybe it's in the genes, but when people say, where do you want to go for a vacation, I always think of going north, and I get forced to go south. Twisted arm slightly, but I love going. I love the north.
Do you do a lot of sailing? Do you do a lot out on the sea?
Yeah, I was in the Coast Guard, and of course, growing up on this island, the summers on the island, I spent a lot of time on the water, and then I joined the Coast Guard when I was young man. Actually, spent 20 years all told, 16 years in reserves, and four in the active duty and on ships and search and rescue boats. And then I've built my own wooden boats, which I've taken out on the lakes and on the ocean as well, main coast. And so, yes, I'm still engaged.
You've built your own wooden boats.
I built two. The last one was what's called a Swamp Scott dory. It's with a friend of mine, who may be listening right now. We harvested trees on his property, milled the lumber, and then I built the boat out of these local materials, 13 different species of Vermont wood in it. I wanted to build a nice-looking craft that you didn't have to use mahogany and teak and all the rarer woods. And it came out pretty nice. It's a nice-looking boat. I made the sail as well. So,
And where is it now?
It's in my shed.
Okay. Yeah,
waiting for next summer.
All right.
Yeah.
And how long did it take you to build it?
All told, I was working on it part-time after I retired from state government. And it took me 4 years, all told. I actually built it in two stages. It took me almost as long to make the sail as it did the boat. So all told, 4 years.
Huh. Why did it take so long to make the sail? I would think that would be less complicated than the boat.
Sail making is amazing.
Not that I do it regularly.
Yeah, it's not just cutting out pieces of cloth and sewing them together. You have to build in the belly of the sail, and everything has to be right dimensions for the boat and so forth. It's an exacting art, really.
We're talking with Charles Johnson. He's from East Montpelier. He is a local author. His most recent book is Ice Ship, The Epic Voyages of the Polar Adventurer Fram. You mentioned you worked with the Agency of Natural Resources. Tell us about that work and also the earlier books that you wrote.
Yes, I for I think it was over 20 years, I was a Vermont state naturalist, and early involvement in endangered species work and natural areas protection. Did a lot of education with adults to kids. That was an old position that had been on the books since since the mid-1800s. And they resurrected it for me later in the 1970s. It was sort of the early versions of what now is called natural heritage protection. You know, we have within the Fish and Wildlife Department, there are a lot of people doing this kind of work, and I was just sort of the guy at that time to carry on this work. I can remember when we didn't have an endangered species list, for example, and people didn't know how to go about protecting them. So I was involved in that, and I was also involved in state land acquisition, buying public land for various reasons, parks and forests, and a number of other things. But that was the main job.
Mm-hmm. We were just talking about the Endangered Species Act on the program recently. There was this story that came out from the World Wildlife Federation talking about how half of the animals on the planet have gone in the last 40 years. Wow.
Yeah, it's pretty sobering. And we have just heard about the puffins, that the virtually all populations of puffins are dying out. The young are not, they're not raising young now. Due to probably warming of the sea, changing of fish species, the herring moving out and other species moving in. So, yeah, it's something that is very, very sobering and can be depressing, and we've just got to keep working at it.
Yeah. At the risk of showing my ignorance, a puffin's a kind of penguin?
It sort of looks like a penguin, but it's a northern seabird. Yeah, it's a... People find them very endearing and cute. They have this remarkable face with a very colorful beak, but they're small. And I guess it would be the northern hemisphere equivalent of a penguin.
I asked you before. Tell us a little bit about the you wrote a couple of books before.
Yeah, the first one I did is called The Nature of Vermont, and that was done in 1980. Actually, it was published in 80, and the thing I'm proudest of is that it's still in print. After all these years, it's gone into its second edition. It's a more popular approach to the Vermont's geology, natural and human histories. And so that was my first one. Then I had a special interest in graduate school in bogs. I like bogs. You might ask why, but I love bogs. And so I wrote a book 5 years later called Bogs of the Northeast, and this is looking at... Again, in a more popular way, looking at bogs across not just New England, but Pennsylvania and New York and further south. So I think it's still, if I've got my history right, it's still the only book that's written solely about bogs in that popular vein. So that's another source of pride for me. Then I've written a couple others with my wife, Nona. I wrote a book called, I wrote the essays for In Season and with her, Watercolors and Journal Entries. That's looking at the natural history of the New England year in color and in through essays about themes of the year. And then I did a small book with Gail Lawrence on fall colors. It's a Vermont Life book on the guide to fall colors. And this was the year to have that book in hand.
Yeah, no kidding.
Take a look.
Wow. You know, it's fascinating to me that you mentioned that Nona keeps a journal every day, and your mom did, too.
My mom did, too. She was not... She in her younger days, she was an artist. She was a pretty good artist. But later, she ended up... was strictly writing, journal writing, leading to fiction. She wrote a lot of unpublished novels and short stories, some of which were published. The short stories were published.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what's the story here? What is the ice ship? What are the epic voyages of the polar adventurer Fram? What's this all about?
Well, the Fram is a Norwegian vessel. It still exists, by the way. It's a museum now in Oslo. But it's a remarkable ship that was built especially to be frozen in. It was not built especially to sail. It was a terrible sailor, but it was built to be frozen in the ice. It was the brainstorm of a great Norwegian explorer, Fridtjof Nansen, who was five others, was the first man to cross Greenland on skis.
Rhymes with Johnson.
Right. By the way, the name Hansen is also a variation of Johnson's.
Okay.
So, and there were several Hansens on these expeditions. There's a book recently published by Hampton Sides, a very well-known author, about a ship called the Jeannette, which is an American polar vessel that was trying to discover the North Pole, whatever that was, that no one knew. This was the late 1800s. No one knew what was north, in the north, in the high Arctic. And the Jeannette, under a man named DeLong, was trying to reach by way of Siberia, go through the Bering Straits and then up into the north of Siberia, into the sea. He got jammed in the ice there. He thought, the DeLong, and thought that at that time that the North Pole and the high Arctic was open an open ocean. That was a prevailing theory. Some thought that also there was a continent in the middle of all this. So he was trying to find that. He got frozen in 1879, and his ship was crushed. It's an, the story that Hampton Sides tells is a fascinating one in and of itself. But pieces of that wreck, 3 years later, showed up on southern Greenland. And they were identified, it was identified as from the Jeannette because it was the names of the crew. There was a checkbook there.
Wow.
So Nansen said, how did this stuff get 3,000 miles away 3 years later? And his theory was that the Arctic was a frozen ocean. There was ice, and that was drifting from east, from Siberia, over the pole, and then around Greenland. They knew that the Greenland currents carried things around the east coast down around the south, and that's where they found these remnants. So this is where he got the idea for the ship. He said, I'm gonna build a ship that it can withstand being frozen in the ice. I'm gonna push it right back where the Jeannette got stuck, and we're gonna drift, over the pole. We're gonna drift around and pop out over in Greenland, and I'll prove that the Arctic Ocean is a frozen ocean.
Wow.
So in 1892, this ship was built in Norway. A remarkable ship. It's variously described as looking like a bathtub or a half of a watermelon sliced lengthwise. What it was designed to do is not fight the ice, but to go with it, so that when the ice started to come to bear on the sides, the ship would rise up like a been described as a watermelon seed being squeezed between the thumb and forefinger. And if by chance it were stuck, then the ship was built incredibly thick. It was at a 3-foot thick hull, three different hulls tucked inside each other.
Wow.
Reinforced with knees and buttresses inside that ended up looking like I don't know, it's like a cathedral. I've said in the book, it's sort of looking like all these buttresses in a cathedral, so that if the ice squeezed, it would it wouldn't crush the ship. The ship had virtually no keel, excuse me, because they didn't want anything to protrude that the ice could crush. The propeller and rudder could be withdrawn, pulled up onto the deck. The cabins were all super insulated and heated. There were 13 men on this trip, and they were staying warm when it was 40 below outside. They could stay warm. Wouldn't need a coat. It was provisioned for 5 years, food.
Wow.
And they jammed themselves into the ice in 1893, and proceeded to drift. And they, not knowing where they were going, not knowing if they would be caught in a gyre, if they'd ever make it across. But over 3 years, they did. One of the interesting side stories is that Nansen and a fellow named Johansson, there we go. And I think Nansen was a very interesting character. He was very moody, very brilliant. He later in life won the Nobel Peace Prize, by the way.
Wow.
Very moody, very handsome. He was this Viking kind of figure, which attracted women. And, he had a little side story there as well. But very moody and got on the nerves of the crew quite a bit. And he also, I think, got bored with this trip because they were drifting and... not knowing, sometimes backwards, sometimes no progress at all. Excuse me again. And so he decided to leave the ship, and he realized halfway through that it was not going to make it over the pole, and no one had ever been to the pole, obviously. So this is when he decided to
leave the ship
with this other man, with two kayaks on two sledges, with 28 dogs. And make it to the pole.
Okay.
And I think he just wanted to get away. He was getting bored. And so he did that. And the plan was to get to the pole and eat the dogs along the way. They took provisions as well. And but he didn't make it. It was too difficult. And he turned south to go back try to not to ever go back to the Fram, but to make it to open water and then take the kayaks to civilization.
Wow.
And, you know, again, we're saying that there's nobody within several thousand miles of this. You know, they're doing this just on their own.
Yeah.
He miscalculated a bit, and they didn't get off the ice in time. They got into the water, and they kayaked to an island where they had to overwinter. And in the Arctic, overwintering in this location, overwintering meant September, October to June. So they made a cave, covered it with walrus hide, and there they stayed for eight, nine months.
Wow.
They had shot enough polar bear, walrus, and seal to stockpile food that they could use throughout the winter. And these two men in the same sleeping bag spent all these months. The next summer, when they could get in the kayaks again, they made it to another island where they just happened to run across a British explorer who took them in his supply ship back to Norway. And this was in September of 96. And it turns out that they arrived in Norway 6 days before the Fram did, having popped out of the ice and coming back. So they had a grand reunion in northern Norway.
So in other words, you could have stayed on the Fram the whole time and gotten back at the same time. Wow, how much fun did you have doing this?
That was, besides being a lot of work, it was a lot of fun. These stories are very compelling, and I marvel at the men who did this. We're talking temperatures of, routinely 30 below, often 40 below, sometimes 65, 70 below.
And we're not talking like, Gore-Tex. I remember reading, you must have read Nathaniel Philbrook's Sea of Glory.
Oh, yes.
I mean, they're all wearing wool coats.
Right.
Which, when you get a wool coat wet, that's worse than not even having a wool coat on.
Right. And what they did, the Norwegians and the other two expeditions as well, Norwegians actually adopted a lot of the Inuit ways of survival in the Arctic. They used furs, hides and furs. They ate off the land and the sea, or off the ice and the sea. They shot as many, and this is perhaps the hard part for some people to realize, that they shot as many things as they could to eat fresh food, which kept scurvy at bay. They never had any scurvy on any of these expeditions. And they traveled with dogs and sledges and skis. And this was very different than what the British and the Americans did, who, especially the British, insisted on man-hauling sledges. It was too beneath them to use dogs. Didn't know how to ski. So it was, very study in contrast. And the subsequent expeditions of the second one to the Canadian Arctic under Otto Sverdrup, who was... went with Nansen on his cross Greenland trip and actually took over the Fram after Nansen left. So he was the captain after the Nansen left to try to find the pole. He did the same thing and even more so in the Canadian Arctic with mapping over 200,000 square miles of that area and eating, as much as they could of muskox, bear, fox, whatever.
How do you live in a cave for the entire winter in the Arctic?
Well, I can only imagine. You have to be very circumspect.
Introspective, maybe?
Introspective. Yeah. They said, Nansen in his diary said that they stopped writing their diary because there's nothing to write about. And plus, the diaries were too black from all the soot. They were, the only heat they had and light was from a blubber lamp.
Wow.
That they made.
Because, remember, it's dark all, pretty much the entire day.
Exactly, yeah.
Wow.
They had all these men on these ships had that character of being able to, withstand and forego. And, they were tough internally, I think. They didn't go crazy. One of the interesting things with Nansen is in Norwegian, he kept calling Johansen, who was part of the crew, and here was Nansen, the boss. He kept referring to him in the formal way of you, And only on after they'd been together for like 4 months in the same sleeping bag did he say, do you think maybe we could call each other by more informal way? And he reverted back to the formal way after they got back to civilization.
Wow.
But, yeah, they had to have a lot of internal fortitude, that's for sure.
You know, I'm almost getting the feeling when I'm talking to you that you were born in the wrong era and that part of you wants to be on this ship.
You're absolutely right. Someone asked me, I said, would you do this? Well, you know, why would you want to do it? I said, oh, yes, if I were 20 years old and had the opportunity, I'd do it. There's something, the allure is, I don't know what it is. It's a physical thing. It's a mental thing. It's the Arctic, by the way, the parts I've seen are absolutely gorgeous, memorable, different than any other landscape on Earth. And it's sort of life-changing to experience it, I think. So maybe that's part of it as well.
How many times have you visited up there?
My wife and I have been twice, both to Baffin Island. We were on a Inuit-led trip in southern Baffin Island, and then we spent some time in mid-Baffin Island, a place called Pangnirtung, and went out on the sea with some Inuit there. And
how did you find that?
Well, my wife was a guide for country walkers, and they were experimenting with wanting to run a trip up there. Actually, Nona implanted that idea. She wanted to go to Ellesmere, which is even more remote. But they said, no, there's no support there. So they organized these experimental trips to Baffin Island, and very difficult because, you know, it's hard to get there. It's expensive. Everything could be canceled on a moment's notice with the weather.
Right.
But there's still, it was just remarkable. And they weren't able to continue these trips because of the logistics, but it gave us the opportunity to see this part.
Wow.
Yeah.
If I go on one of those trips with you and your wife, can I bring my own sleeping bag? Is that all right? Wow, what a story. Thanks for coming in, Charles. That was really a treat. Charles Johnson is the author of Ice Ship, The Epic Voyages of the Polar Adventurer Fram. Are you going to be talking anywhere?
I think the first one is, it's going to be in Boston at the Explorers Club on November 7th. In Montpelier, I'm doing a slideshow using these old photos and some of my own on the 19th of November. It's a joint thing with Bear Pond Books and the Kellogg Hubbard Library, so it's at 7 o'clock at the Kellogg Hubbard.
Okay.
Yeah.
Will you send me an email week before that and remind me? Because that sounds like it'd be really great.
Yeah.
Thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much, Mark.
Charles Johnson, the author of Ice Ship, The Epic Voyages of the Polar Adventurer Fram. We'll take a quick break. We'll be back. John Dillon joins us next. He's the news director of Vermont Public Radio.
We are high performance, low pressure. Walker Volkswagen on the Barry Montpelier Road is celebrating its grand reopening, and you are invited. We have finished our dealership's renovation and expansion project and are excited to share our passion for Volkswagen with you. We are so excited that we are giving away a new Volkswagen Beetle. I told you we are seriously celebrating. Take advantage of Walker Volkswagen's grand reopening celebration with our deeply discounted upfront pricing that eliminates all the gimmicks.